before we got to this piece, Dr. Krieger and I had worked on a project with some African-American Latino boys all over the state of California in a hands-on process. We were funded by the California Endowment. And as a part of that program, it morphed. And as more and more of the issues on suspension, expulsion, kids getting in school-to-prison pipeline, the endowment came back and funded us to work with the California Teachers Association and the University of California, San Francisco, on this particular project of how we could look at some of the issues behind it and change Ed Code policy within the state of California. So on February 28th, you all remember how President Obama rolled out the I think it was called the Brothers and Keepers campaign. Well, simultaneously, the California Endowment launched something called the Sons and Brothers campaign. And this was the California's version of the larger campaign. And as I said, we actively collaborated with them. And so that is how we developed over, actually this has been going on for about 3 years. We've actually been working with the groups to come together to try to develop some changes in the education code in California to deal with this particular issue.
We have no personal financial disclosures to make. I'm going to give you a brief overview of what we're going to cover in the presentation. We're going to cover a fair bit of material. We're happy to answer questions at the end. Also, we have cards up here, so we're happy to be in touch with all of you. First, we're going to look at where school discipline policy is now in California. Then we're going to look at the connections between health writ large, health writ broad, and the impacts of inequality. Then we're going to look at the school environment that students need, and then we're going to look at how to create a supportive school environment that doesn't push youth out of schools.
So there is a crisis in our schools regarding suspension and expulsion statistics. And there are many reasons for the high rates. And I just wanted to describe two of those reasons. They're not the only ones, but they're the ones that we have worked on and observed where we are. One's called implicit bias. And that essentially is those things that we grew up with, that we experienced as children moving into adulthood, that we consciously impose upon the children around where we work with, that leads to many of our children ending up in some kind of disciplinary situation. The second one is something called unconscious bias, which you may have heard or heard of or heard not. But unconscious bias is essentially the same thing. It's really about those experiences and all of those things that we bring to the table from our own personal baggage that we unconsciously impose upon children that leads them into these kinds of issues where they fall into some kind of disciplinary category. So how do these issues play out in a classroom? How does these issues play out between staff and students with regard to challenging authority? I don't know if you've heard the term willful defiance. Has anybody ever heard that term? It's this broad term where a teacher, a nurse, and can do this too. Any health professional that works in a school, if a child comes in and does something that they don't like based upon maybe their unconscious biases, they can have that child suspended. There is no definition for willful defiance. We've been trying to change the Ed Code in California to place a definition on what it is so that people can't just willy-nilly throw kids out of school.
We have situations where students have been expelled for wearing a hat. The teacher has requested that the student take off the hat. You know, no, it's willful defiance. I'm refusing to do that. Okay, are we contributing to the dropout epidemic? Exclusionary school policies do push students out of school and remove them from school supports and increase the likelihood that those students will drop out. Dropouts cost the state of California $19.5 billion annually, with a B.
So as you can see, there are a lot of health problems that affect students, and specifically students of color. But you as health professionals and educators must keep making the connection that these things affect health and school climate and student achievement. They are subjected, our students are subjected to many outside stressors. So school is one of the safest, best places for students, and we shouldn't be pushing them out. As we seek to understand these external stressors of our students, sometimes we get caught up in the rhetoric. For example, why aren't parents trying harder? Or don't these parents care? So students who are most likely to act out and get suspended are generally more likely to be dealing with a lot of trauma outside the school environment. Think about how health is impacting school. A lot of kids in the school, students, are students who are not most likely to act out and be expelled, and who need the most support. They're the ones that tend to have the most traumatizing events outside the school environment. And then when they walk on the campus or school, that's when it all manifests itself. So we should be very mindful of that, and we should really care about how that interacts and how we think about that when we see those kids come on the school campus. For example, peer-to-peer relationships, as an example. Or what does their home environment look like? Or what are some of the trauma issues? What does student achievement look like for these kids? What is the positive school climate that they experience? And what about their overall health and the equity behind that overall health?
And as you can see, the slide that goes with Jim's present. No, you did perfectly. But gives you the ratio of how, of what the outcomes of some of these issues are. The protective factors that foster healthy, resilient children and youth, these are fairly predictable, but we're still working on getting them implemented in all of our schools. Belonging, safety, mastery, sense of competence, and meaning to the youth and the students, not what we think is important and that they should be meaningful for them. Similarly, the protective factors that predict student successes. This builds on Bonnie Bernard and Sarah Trubridge's theoretical models, but all of these in school, school connectedness is a huge predictor of success and health throughout life. So connections to caring adults, that can be broken down into connections to caring adults, high expectations, and meaningful work and careers.
If I could just interject.
Please.
These three pieces were added to our overall work plan, and it culminated from our work with the Boys and Men of Color program that we had in California. We worked with boys in an elementary school and middle school in Los Angeles, elementary and a middle school in East Oakland, the toughest parts of those cities. And one of the things that when we polled the boys and found was that they found there was one caring adult that they could go to about anything. They also worked better in classrooms when teachers had high expectations for them. And then we took them on numerous field trips. We took them to EA Sports, for example. And kids thought we'd go in there, all you have to do is just be creative. And when they talked to the African American, the Latino, the Asian, the females that were working for EA Sports, all of them had master's degrees. All of them had these high degrees in science and mathematics and geometry, because that's what it takes to make those things that your children or my daughter play with. And once they saw that, they started to make the connection of how important a meaningful career had. That's just one example. We took them tons of places. So, what could we do differently?
I messed up.
Sorry. Let me go back. So, what can we do differently?
Thank you.
we tried to take a look at an holistic approach on students' well-being. And you can see all the different things that we try to do when we're working with students, and also as we work with adults that work with students. So how does this fit into the broader framework and environmental factors? And then how does that distill those concepts that work with both the personal and the broad levels that we deal with our students and with the adults? And we know all this from research. We have to take a systems approach when we do this work. So, as professionals, we have resources to support each of these bullet points. We may also need to expand our competencies to make certain we are presenting the information appropriately and that we are reinforcing the messages across multiple venues. Now this message. So I'm sure all of you are familiar with zero tolerance policies. Is everyone pretty much familiar with zero tolerance policies? And they've been around, the history of zero tolerance policies, they've been around a long time. But have they been effective? That's the question. And we have found that zero tolerance policies actually exasperate the issue. We found that when you have a negative policy like a zero tolerance, it basically has no common sense alternative to discipline. So, the question is, where are the positive school-wide strategies that will support students in schools?
One of these approaches is a trauma-informed care approach. And trauma-informed care is essentially a systems approach that looks at everyone involved. It engages the survivors, the student, the family, the school, the community, any other individuals or groups involved in that, minimizes victimization, and starts to rebuild relationships so that teachers and schools can define positive approaches and really support learning for the student within the school.
So some of the other evidence-based alternatives, how many have heard restorative justice practices? Okay, all right. And this is kind of one of the new things now. We put the website up there for you, those of you that are not familiar with it. But essentially, now I'm going to read this because my printer did not work right. My notes are so small, I got to put it this close to my face so I can see what I'm saying. But basically, restorative justice practices create a harmonious learning environment where young people are able to self-regulate their own behavior and learning. And they have four basic components: respect for everyone, responsibility, repairing, developing the skills within our school community, reintegration, that means bringing them back into the school without suspending them or expelling them. In other words, the final result of that is to find those alternative programs within the school environment so they don't spend days out on the street not learning or getting into trouble. That's essentially what that says. The second part is something called positive behavior intervention program. Now, for 30 years, I was either a special ed teacher or a director of special ed for a large urban school district. And one of the things that we've been doing in special education for a long time for individualized education plans is something called a positive behavior intervention plan. And that plan essentially is morphed into this. What it is that you provide a list of positive behaviors for a student that has been misbehaving, and then you measure that, and then you redevelop the program based upon what the student has done in terms of doing something positive about the behaviors. In other words, you kind of throw out the misbehavior part. If they, even if they're in the plan, if they do something that does not really is not the best thing about the plan, then you reevaluate that and say, okay, that didn't work. Now, what can we What other behaviors can we really list to help the child and their parents work on that will help him stay in a positive light? That's essentially what a positive behavior intervention supports are. And we put the website up so you could go take a look at that.
Trauma-informed schools is essentially what I was speaking about before. This is, again, just this whole systems approach, making sure that the pieces are connected and that there is a great deal of sensitivity to the fact that trauma experiences can stay with students and individuals for their entire life. The good behavior game is another one of these where essentially you take students and divide them into teams and you compete for, you set up a system for competing for positive behavior. So instead of getting demerits or something like that, you flip the paradigm around. And the social emotional learning piece is another approach which focuses on self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, relationship skills, and responsible decision making. We've all seen those kids who walk into a new environment and they just seem okay. It's like they can cope. They've never been there before. They don't quite know what. They haven't been exposed to it before, but they're aware enough, they're reflective enough that they're just comfortable. I mean, that's often what you see with students who have been through the social emotional learning type of experience. Lest we forget, another really important approach is physical activity. We now know that physical activity is related to academic achievement and brain function. Obviously, sports and many team sports develop social skills and social behaviors, as well as increasing self-esteem, reducing anxiety and depression, and improving psychological well-being. Okay, I'm going to walk you through a couple of pieces of evidence from Michigan, from Minnesota, and then California. If you'll do this part, I want to get over here for the next slide. Okay, Michigan introduced a system where they essentially reduced suspensions and did it without increases in disruptive behavior within the school, and they reduced about 1,500 days of suspension. Minnesota is another state which both in primary and secondary schools reduced suspensions by 30% to 50% in four districts. Okay, this is California data, which breaks this down a little bit more. This is from Garfield High School in LA, a pretty rough school. Okay, what happens, and we also have these data for middle schools. I'm sorry. Jim, you get to go point for me, please. Thank you. Thank you. Sorry about that. Sorry, I didn't quite think through that. Okay, the red line is reduced suspensions. The green line is the increase in API scores, the Academic Performance Index. What I was about to say before is this is Garfield High School in Los Angeles. We have similar data for middle schools and elementary schools. They all look exactly the same. As suspensions go down, the API, in this case for all students, goes up. The second graph, again, the suspensions going down, what you see in the next line is at 115 points was the increase on the Academic Performance Index for Latino students. The next one, the middle green box, is for free lunch students, 114% increase. And for English language learners, 104 point increase. At different schools, the ethnicities and the ethnicity breakdown is different. For example, it may be African American students instead of Latinos. But for all of the districts, these graphs look exactly the same in terms of the pattern. It is really pretty dramatic.
Oops, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
So, what's in our future? We in California have really taken a tiered approach to how we want to help solve this issue. We've taken an approach from the state level, the district level, the school level, the classroom level. 2 years ago, Governor Brown pushed through and the legislature passed something called the Local Control Funding Formula. And what it is it took all the categorical programs, gone. And they took that money and they gave it back to school districts and individual schools based upon their need. Okay, so if there was a school that was in a poor district, they got more. A school that was in an upscale rich district, they got less. Sure, there was complaints, but it was much more equitable. But there was a caveat to this. They also passed something called the Local Control Accountability Plan, or LCAP for short. Now, the LCAP has 8 factors into it. The ones that we have been entrusted with through the endowment and CTA and UCSF are the two that really determine the issues around suspension, expulsion, and all of that. One's called school climate. The other one is called student achievement, which really refers to the academic performance index that Mary had talked about in the previous 2 slides. And the whole idea is that districts are accountable. Oh, by the way, one of the things that the legislature smartly did was the State Department of Ed does all the evaluations. Districts don't evaluate themselves anymore. There's no more of this, that crazy stuff where a district says, well, I'll evaluate my own API.
I did really well.
And I did really well. That's gone. So they have a unified measuring device. The academic performance index is statewide. It's tried and proven over a series of years. That's what they measure the student achievement part of. So if there's a district out there that decides that they haven't really done a lot of work on trying to provide some of these alternative programs to reduce suspensions and expulsions with selected demographic groups and increase the academic proportion of those groups that you saw, those districts lose funding under LCFF. However, if there's a district out of there where it's a rural, medium-sized, large, and they have really shrunk the suspension and expulsions of their students, mostly of color, and they have increased the API for their students over the Common Core subjects, those districts maintain or may even get more funding. So it's really based upon what the districts truly are going to do. The evaluation is the key point. All these 8 factors are the key points. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you. Have any questions?
So let's open it up for all the all presenters.
Oh, sure. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thank you.
Go ahead. I know you have a question.
I have a question. You were talking about the API scores increase with the suspension decrease, and thinking about that, I work with a probation office whenever they were doing their testing on these kids coming in, and they were very highly intelligent, and so what you're saying, if I look at that, and looking with that thought, is I'm looking, these kids that are getting in trouble are there for testing day, because nobody ever said that they weren't intelligent. So is there something that's showing that they're successful in life because they're highly creative, highly intelligent, they have high self-esteem, these kids that are coming into juvenile hall, but they were lacking that gatekeeper to say right and wrong.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
With the API scores are increasing, that they're there in school, but how are they adjusting socially, and are they marketable in the job form?
Sure. I'm just going to shorten the question. The question essentially is, what happens with those students that have fallen into the juvenile justice system come back to the public school system, and can they, even though they're bright students, can they move through that system in terms of the school climate and testing in order to be successful? Is that kind of general?
Well, what I'm saying is API 4 is one way to measure, you're showing, they're not sustaining the kids that are having problems in school, their API 4 is for school as whole is going up. Well, actually, I can see that happening because they're there assessing data.
Yeah, let me give you a little bit more because we really condensed this. We've done this training with teachers, and we have condensed this because it was a time constraint. But part of the issue in California is the API has been around for a long time. It is it's a holistic test over the Common Core. So you've got language arts, science, math, and I just can't remember the fourth one, but there's four. Common Core, they're called Common Core standards. And that's what students in specific grade levels are evaluated on. And that's what formulates what they call the Academic Performance Index. The part of the program where the local control funding formula came in was just passed, this is 2014, 2012. The first round of accountability started last year for districts on a voluntary basis till July 1 of 2015. That basically gave the districts a year to really get their system down. And once July 1st, 2015 comes, it's mandatory for all the 1,001 school districts in California. So it's really not there yet. The API, they've been doing that for a substantial number of years. But the key thing is the demographic data. One of the demographic, if you could, go online and find this if you go to the California Department of Education, State Department of Education, you can go online, you can look at the breakdown of demographic data. In that data, you'll find that there is an area for students coming out of the juvenile justice system, coming back into the public school system, and you can take a look at where they fit in terms of not just API, attendance, behavior, suspensions. It's broad. It's very broad. We kind of funneled it down. So to answer your question, I would suggest you might just want to take a look at that and see, and then you can kind of see, because we don't really have that data that you're asking about, whether those kids coming out of, like juvenile hall, how do they perform, or alternative schools, how do they perform on the API? But you can find that data.
Actually, if the suspension or non-suspension is helping those kids succeed,
well,
is what I'd like to see.
Yeah, you can, you won't see it in a...
Yeah,
you could get some anecdotal pieces, but you're going to basically, if you want to see the data piece, you can pull that. But as far as anecdotal, you know, that's kind of what we did with our kids. They were under all the testing guidelines of their schools, but we did a lot of anecdotal work with them and their parents, and even what caregivers they had. But I wouldn't see, if you were to pull the data from the State Department of Ed, I don't think you would see anecdotal pieces in there.
The other important piece of this is that school disciplinary policy has been a really hot topic in California for especially the last 4 years. So it's really early days to be able to say, are they successful in life? You know, we're not quite there. There's much more awareness. We do still have some major issues to work through. I mean, we have to grapple with the money to implement, as everybody does. We've got to grapple with the money to implement these programs, even though they're showing great promise and preliminary evidence. We need to be able to see these graphs where we can correlate what's going on.
And if I could just follow up, in California, you can look at the students in juvenile hall, you can look at students in the California Youth Authority, and it's because they have their own school system, but they're under LCAP. They're under local control funding formula, just like everybody else. You can pull that data out and take a look at how those kids that return from the system and how they fared in the system. So that information is there too, because the State Department oversees all of that. What school were you at? What school district were you in, California?
We were in the Long Beach School District.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. We know it well.
Yes, we do.
For the Garfield High School, is that just within one academic year that you saw this?
No, actually, will this take me back?
There you go.
Yes, okay. So this goes. I'm sorry, these are relatively small, but along the bottom you have the timeline, which goes from the 08-09 school year through 2010-11. So this is over 3 years.
Yeah.
One of the things that's important that we've talked about with the schools who are doing this, anecdotal though it is, they say that the schools are much calmer. They say that there's a much stronger sense of trust, that kids are not being confronted by police coming onto the campus, which has happened. And there's actually starting to be a little bit of literature on this, that if you don't introduce kids to the juvenile justice system, to the police, to law enforcement, that, you know, other ways and mechanisms are then developed to address these things, which is obviously what we're proposing within the school. So there's starting to be a few articles scattered around about this. But as we talked to people who had been on campus, they said, you know, wow, I was there a few years ago, and everybody's pager was going off, and there was constantly somebody having an issue. And I spent a whole day there, and nobody's pager went off. So, I mean, I don't have the quantitative data. Well, we do here, but it's very interesting to hear people say, you know, it's calm, and you get a sense that people are really building relationships. And there isn't this disruptive force. Of course.
So can you talk about the training involved for the teachers and staff working with the young people, and how, like, getting staff together, getting teachers together to be able to use it?
Very interesting. You should bring that up.
Very interesting. You should bring that up.
Go for it. I want to give you some background first. So
keep the question, please.
I forgot the question. Senior moment.
Training for the
teachers. Teacher training regarding these kinds of practices. Okay. First of all, I will tell you, it has been a struggle to try to get all of the coalition members, not just teachers, but we have been working with superintendents, County Department of Ed, principals, this California School Boards Association, and of course CTA, which is the largest teacher union in California, to try to move this. We have had work with the legislature. We actually have a committee on the status of African American Latino boys that's headed at the Senate level. And so we have support within the legislature, but it has not come easy. It has been a struggle over the last 3-4 years. We have just finally now got to the point where Mary, myself, and one of my colleagues we're getting ready to do a training starting with teachers. The whole work plan within that endowment funded us for was to do this work, but we kept getting blocked by, there was groups out there, obviously, like charter schools, that did not want to see this happen, because what happens in the public schools if you start reducing the suspension expulsion? Parents start feeling better about the public schools. They see their student scores go up. What happens to a lot of charter schools? So we got a lot of resistance on a lot of levels, not just charters, but a lot of levels. But we have finally overcome that. We're going to do a presentation to the largest governing body of California Teachers Association, which I used to be a part of. It's probably about 800 teacher leaders, nurses, some administrators, not a whole bunch, in January. And we will do a presentation to the three main committees that are assigned the issues around the suspension, expulsion, school to prison kind of issues. And then what we will do is we will take that training on the road, myself and Mary mostly. What you see is maybe, not even a third, a quarter of what the real training looks like. It's an hour, it's a good hour training. We get deep into all these issues. And we will start going to school districts. We'll be allowed to deal with administrators, superintendents, school board members, and teachers, and bus drivers, and cafeteria workers, and all of those people, school nurses, my wife was a school nurse, all of those people that work with children on a school environment, whomever that may be. And we feel very good about that. But it's going to take time. This is not something, we've been fighting with the adults. It hadn't been the kids. It's the adults we've been fighting with to get to where we just finally. And Governor Brown, in his acceptance speech after the November election, the first thing out of his mouth was, we're moving forward with the local control funding formula, where we're moving forward with the accountability plan, and districts better be ready. Now, if you know anything about Jerry Brown, when he says something like that, you can almost take it to the bank. So for us to work with teachers, that's coming. But it's not just teachers. It's all school employees, because that's the only way you're going to change this.
Thank you for that.
Of course.
Any other questions?
Thank you all for your questions.
One additional comment on that. We're also hoping to be able to get funding so that we can actually walk out into the school district and say, you have a plan due July 1st.
That's right.
So we want to give you... So what you guys have seen is sort of the introductory part with why we should be moving forward in these directions, why the zero tolerance policies are a bad thing. The second piece of this is really how you get ready for this document, how you prepare this document, how you make sure you've got your parents engaged, how you're looking at your data, what your plans are for reducing the push-out policies related to school disciplinary policies. So we've got a lot of work to do over the next 6 months or so, and people are hungry for this. So that's the other piece. We're really trying to be very responsive. People have said, this is great, but where do I go next? The other thing that all of you should sort of know, is everybody in here a health professional? Do we have anybody not involved in health? Okay. You guys are way ahead, because we're talking to the choir a little bit here. Teachers know this stuff. School nurses know this because they see it. But if you talk about overall health and well-being to an administrator, that may not be at the top of their radar when they're thinking about performance. I mean, so be aware that it's much easier to have this conversation with the public health audience than it is with folks who have had to, because of the structures of the system, live only in one part of the educational system. And also, like many other states, California really has, Prop 13 just decimated our public school funding way back when. So like everybody, we have those issues that we're contending with in the middle of this. I hope that helps just a little bit.
Thank you for staying.
You guys all get awards.